and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Stephen Buhner. And I'm going to tell you something. This book needs to be on the bookshelf of every single person on the face of the earth. It is one of the most important books I've ever read. It's called Herbal Antibiotics, Natural Alternatives for Treating Drug-Resistant Bacteria, the second edition and completely revised. It's really one of the most amazing books I've read in a long time. And that says a lot because I read a lot of books. So welcome, Stephen, and thank you for taking the time to come on my show and share this very important book.
You're welcome.
Before we get started, can you just tell us a little bit about you so people know who you are and where they can find you and get a hold of this book? Because I know when you sent it to me, it wasn't out yet.
No, it's just come out, actually, and I've been involved with alternative medicine for most of my life, really, since the early to mid-70s, and I've been involved with herbal medicine for 27 years, I guess, now. And, I grew up in a fairly conservative medical family. My great uncle was Surgeon General of the United States when I was in grade school, and my grandfather was president of the Kentucky Medical Association. So they were fairly hardcore pharmaceutical doctors. But my great-grandfather was a horse and buggy physician, and he used mostly herbs in his practice because he began practicing long before pharmaceuticals were in use. And he's really the inspiration for my work. So I've been really looking at a kind of a different paradigm that, you know, not so this way or that way. And so I've been really into herbal medicine and alternative medicine, holistic practice for quite a long time.
So what exactly are you? Are you an herbalist or are you a naturopath? What are you?
No, it's hard to say. You know, I spent 15 years as a psychotherapist and had trained in a lot of humanistic psychotherapy and bodywork practices, and I've been deeply studying contemplative spirituality practices for about 40 years now. So, and then the herbal medicine goes together with that. So, in reality, I'm very much a holistic practitioner, and I didn't really fit well into the boxes of life. My college work was in transcultural epistemology, which is looking at the way different cultures experience reality and understand reality. And so mostly I've just been looking at the development of really an entirely different paradigm of healing in the United States, and have spent most of my life studying and practicing in various aspects of that. So some people think I'm an herbalist, and that works fine enough for me. I don't have any problem with that.
Well, it's about time, you know, it's time for a change. Pharmaceuticals are wreaking havoc on everybody, and this is just such a great book. And I have to say, I interviewed you maybe 7 or 8 years ago on your book for natural testosterone. So for those of you that are men that have problems with impetus or prostate, that was just really an excellent interview that he did, and his book was fabulous. It's called The Natural Testosterone Plan. And he's got a whole list of books on Lyme and Earth for your liver, and there's just a whole list of them. So where can they find those books, Stephen?
Well, Amazon has all of them that are still in print, and even some that aren't still in print. And then there's my website, which is GaianStudies.org, which is GaianStudies.org. But the books are fairly widely available, so they're not that hard to find.
So this book is mainly about resistant organisms. So what are the resistant organisms that we need to be particularly aware of? Because some people
Well, I think when I did the first edition of this book back in, I wrote it in 98, it came out in 99, there were 12 primary resistant organisms that the medical establishments around the world were concerned about. Now, in this one, there's 21 of them, and that doesn't even include all of the various strains, which that knocks it up to about 40. So the thing is that when antibiotics were discovered, they were really kind of a miracle cure for a lot of diseases that were quite hard to treat, and they worked really well, and as a result, they began to be used all of the time pretty much indiscriminately, and there's literally millions of tons of them are used all of the time, and as a result, bacteria have been developing more and more resistance ever since they came into commercial use in 1946. So right now, you know, the most people have heard of, you know, resistant Staphylococcus or MRSA, and that's probably the most common one people that have heard of, but there's a significant number of others, and many of them are at the point where there's very few, if any, antibiotics that can treat them. And so there's starting to be more and more outbreaks in hospitals that are extremely hard to treat, and it's getting to be a real serious problem, and hence, you know, I've been interested in this since 91, so I really wanted to start looking at what we could really do if antibiotics become useless, which they are.
So this book is very detailed, and it tells you exactly what kinds of things you need to take and what they are and what they can treat. So I know that there's going to be a lot of information that I don't ask the right question because I have so many questions. So during this interview, if there's something that you think is more important than what I'm asking, please speak up and talk about it, okay?
Surely.
Because there's just so much information here. I want to make sure you get out the most important things. But one of the things I wanted to ask about was, tell us about the different kinds of infections. You talk in here about systemic, and you talk about localized, and you talk about some being in specific organs and some of the herbs. And you talk also, you say that these herbal treatments are very successful in treating these things, which I think is very important to know. But sometimes you talk about how they get in particular places in your body, and you have to take a certain combination to make sure it gets inside that organ. So could you just give us briefly about what is the different kinds of infections that we can get and why we need to pay attention to where they are and what they are so we'll know that we use the right thing to do it with?
Well, surely. So I make a primary distinction in the book between systemic resistant infections and localized, meaning that it's in one particular area of the body. So a systemic infection is like a resistant staph, which basically spreads throughout the body. And most of the people I've seen have that. The way it first starts appearing is they start having kind of boils or ulcers that begin appearing on different parts of their body. Sometimes it'll be just an infection on their foot that won't heal, but it's happening because there's this resistant organism that is widely spread through the bloodstream throughout the body, in which case what you need to use then is a systemic antibacterial. And for a long time, for whatever reason, nobody's herbal medicine is, in a lot of ways, it has been sort of, it had never really developed the kind of sophistication that it could have. And we've been really seeing over the last 30 years or so it beginning to really come into its own. So the concept of a systemic antibacterial herb that will spread throughout the body and is, you know, very, very strong and as effective as antibiotics is kind of a new idea. Nevertheless, there's a number of them out there. So that's the kind of thing that's a systemic infection. So a localized infection would be something like if you have a urinary tract infection. There's a number of different resistant organisms. E. coli is one that can actually cause a fairly intense urinary tract infection that's very hard to treat, even with multiple antibiotics. So if you take an herb that is excreted through the urinary passages like juniper berry is. When you take it internally, the body really doesn't know what to do with it, and so it tries to get rid of the chemicals in the juniper berry by having it go through the urinary passages and out of the body. And that's exactly why it's so good as an antibacterial, because it completely scours that whole system clean. And juniper, the constituents in juniper berry are extremely strong. So, you know, there's sort of internal and external localized. Another example of localized is if you have a skin infection and a number of the resistant bacteria occur. If somebody's having an operation in a hospital, for instance, and there's an incision, those wounds can get infected by extremely resistant organisms, and so the wound just will never heal. In those instances, the best thing to use is honey. And as a matter of fact, a number of people in Europe, in the UK, for instance, it's standard medical practice in hospitals now to use honey for surgical wounds to keep them from getting infected or to heal them if they've got a resistant infection. So those are the kind of the two distinctions that I'm talking about in the book.
Well, just so that we're clear here, you don't mean go down to the grocery store and buy a jar of honey.
Well,
you
actually,
honey,
that,
right?
You know, would work just fine. The part of the problem, just to make a distinction, is the kind of honey that they sell in grocery stores, like clover honey or things like that, sometimes they're adulterated, and it's really hard to tell. So what I really am talking about in the book is a good wildflower honey that you can get at a farmer's market or a health food store. If it's wildflower rather than a specific kind like a clover, it's going to tend to be stronger. And honey like that has been used for, you know, millennia for healing these kinds of wounds. And it's really, really good. Of course, once the studies showed that honey was really effective against virtually every resistant organism that there is, the pharmaceutical companies in the UK got involved, and then they created a honey called Meta Honey, which is the only thing legal to use there. But it actually is just a specific kind of honey. All honeys will work to some extent, but the best ones really are a good wildflower organic honey.
Now, can you put this on topically and ingest it, or
no? It's basically a topical application. So if you've got an infected wound that won't heal, or like a burn. See, one of the things about burns is that it removes the top surface of skin, which is a real strong protector for our body, and then quite often staph bacteria will get in there and will just begin to run rampant. So if you cover a really severe burn, even, you know, third-degree burns, with honey like that, the honey will stop the infection. But what's more than that, it keeps the skin moist and stops it from drying out, which is a severe problem with burns. And, you know, the studies have shown you'll get almost complete regeneration of the skin and muscle tissue with very little scarring if you do that. So it's really the best thing to use for that kind of a wound. And, you know, one of the things I did in this book, which drove my publisher crazy, is the reference section, the peer-reviewed journal reference section. I think I've got 4,000 to 6,000 reference articles in the back from studies on all of these plants, and you know, their efficacy is no longer in doubt. The real problem is the recalcitrance of the traditional pharmaceutical medical approach. In this country, in the United States at least, they just don't want to use it, and that's the problem. It's not that the stuff doesn't work.
Does it also help if you ingest it?
Honey's a really good substance. Now, I use a certain blend for colds and flus, but if you're really wanting to treat a systemic bacterial infection, no, honey is not the way to go, because it's most of the compounds are going to change in the stomach. They're not going to get across the stomach lining into the bloodstream, which is what you need.
Okay.
So I mean, it's a good nutritive substance, and it's great for that, but it's not an internal systemic thing. It's mostly for its topical use, really.
Okay. Can you tell us the difference between gram positives and gram negatives and why that's important to know?
Well, bacteria are, the important thing to understand is bacteria are the oldest life forms on this planet. They've been around about 3.5 billion years, and they've engaged in a lot of evolutionary innovation. They're really quite amazing. And so a gram, the word gram, it's named after a guy, as many things in medicine are, and he basically found that bacteria, he would try to stain them so he could identify them when he killed them and looked at them under a microscope. And some of them took a stain really well, and some of them didn't. So the ones that take the stain, basically it stains their skin, their outer protein envelope, or their cell wall, that's called a gram positive. And the gram negative ones don't take a stain, and that's all that means. But a gram positive bacteria usually just has a very thick cell wall, and that's all it has, just a single cell wall, even though it's thick. A gram-negative bacteria, it has two cell walls, and it's got a space in between them. So they're much harder to kill because it's like having a moat around the castle. So you have to go through the first cell wall and then through the space and then through the second cell wall if you're trying to kill them. So they tend to be a little more difficult to treat and then gram-positive, and they tend to, you know, be fairly nasty sometimes if you get a systemic one. Like Klebsiella is a gram-negative, and it's a very dangerous particular gram-negative organism now that they are having outbreaks in hospitals around the country and Canada, and it's there's very, very few pharmaceutical options for that at this point.
So how do the treatments vary for each one?
You mean in terms of using herbs?
Yes.
Well, basically, the thing that I've done with the book is I looked at systemic plants, for instance, if we're looking at, you know, a systemic resistant infection, whether it's gram-negative or positive. And the basic thing that you're looking for is plants that have been found to be highly systemic and highly antimicrobial, and then find ones that are active against either whatever the organisms are that you're looking at. And some plants tend to be highly active more against gram-positive. Others are very specific for some gram-negative. So, you know, usually you just have to take slightly higher doses of the herb for longer if you're treating gram-negative, because they're a little bit harder to treat. There's one thing I did in the book is I began talking about the concept of herbal synergists. And herbal synergists are plants that increase the activity of an herbal medicine or a pharmaceutical, either one, or that help more of the drug or the herb get into the body and thus be more effective. And so there are some herbal synergists that have been tested quite well that will actually help more of the herb get into the body and have a more potent impact on a gram-negative organism, for instance. And so I talk about those as well, so you can sort of, if you've got a really serious gram-negative infection, that you can add one of those to the blend and it'll help potentiate the herb.
I just want to say for my listeners that in this book, you give specific things about how which plants that you need to take for what kind of infection, what kind of combinations, how often you need to take them. And it's, I think you emphasize that it's very important that you do this with diligence. You can't just take a dose and then wait another day and take another dose.
Yeah, we're not talking about an upset stomach here. I mean, one of the things that I've been concerned about, because I trained in mathematics for a while in college and wanted to be a theoretical mathematician for quite a long time. And, you know, when I see an exponential growth curve, I can't help but understand what that means. And basically what that is that, you know, it's a thing that doubles all the time, for instance, is one way to look at it. There's 1 and 2 and 4 and 8 and 16 and 32 and 64 and 128. And pretty soon, you know, the numbers start getting really big. Well, when antibiotics first came out, there were only a few resistant bacteria, but how rapid they were becoming resistant, it was a straight exponential growth curve. And bacterial researchers have been saying for a long time.
Hello? Uh-oh, we've disappeared. I think something's happened to our connection. Don, are you there? Don?
And if doctors don't know what's wrong with somebody, they should never even give antibiotics. We need to reduce our usage down to virtually nothing. But, of course, that didn't happen. And so what's happened is they're basically saying that within about 10 years, we're going to be looking at the end of pharmaceutical antibiotics having very much effectiveness for most of these drugs. And in addition, and this is a fact that really, people just can't make any sense out of it. I can't either. But all of the major pharmaceutical companies in the world have stopped all research and development on new antibiotics. There are no more in the pipeline. And nobody really understands that, but the people that have been following it said they're doing that because there's not enough money in it. So the thing is, we're looking at this point where we're not going to have pharmaceuticals and we need to have options. And that means that if you get really sick with a resistant organism and it's spreading through your body, that when you begin to treat it, you have to be really focused. You have to understand that these kind of infections can be very serious. So when you start treating it, you have to really stay on top of it, and you can't stop prematurely, and you have to use fairly large doses. And I've been working with people with resistant staph primarily over the last 10 or 15 years, and it will respond to herbs, but you just have to use relatively high doses, and you have to be real diligent about it.
Excuse me. If we wanted to go out and have a medicine cabinet in our house and go out and stock that medicine cabinet, what would you suggest that we put in there? Because, I mean, there's a lot of things in this book, so what would be the things that we start out, the basic things to put in our medicine cabinet?
Okay, I think there's 8 or 10 herbs that I identified in there as the absolute primary ones, including both systemic and localized. So the systemic herbs, the one I've been using the longest is an herb from the mid-region of Africa called Cryptolepis. And it's an herb primarily used for malaria over there, but it's also been used by all the people in that region for gram-positive and gram-negative infections. And in fact, it's a very broad-spectrum systemic antibacterial. It works extremely well. I really like that one. There's another one from that region called Alcornia, which is really good. Exactly the same kind of description. Then the next two I really like. One is called Seta, or Seta acuta is the species name. Now, Seta is a great plant because it's an invasive botanical throughout much of the world, and it's invasive along the Gulf Coast of the United States. And it's an extremely strong, systemic, broad-spectrum antibacterial. And the fourth one of those I really like is called Bidens, B-I-D-E-N-S. It's Bidens pilosa is the one I use most often, and it's also an invasive botanical. It's a broad-system antibacterial. It's a little weaker than those other three, but nevertheless, it grows throughout the United States. And those are the four systemics I try to have on hand all the time. And then the localized ones, the primary ones that I have around, I have honey always. Any berberine-containing plant. Now, that would be golden seal, which most people have heard of. But there's maybe 10 or 15 different plants that have a lot of berberine in it. There's an invasive tree in the east coast of the U.S. called philodendron, which is very strong in berberine. And those plants, like for anything like salmonella or any kind of GI tract-resistant infection, that E. coli, the 157, that's really dangerous for people, it's really good. Any of those plants are extremely good for those kind of GI tract things. And then juniper berry, which is really good for urinary tract infections. those are for sure the seven that I always have on hand. And with those, you can treat virtually anything.
That's really good to know. I wanted to ask you about some specific... Well, first I want to ask you about... I noticed that you use licorice in a lot of your blends. And even golden seal. I know that both of those can cause high blood pressure in some people. Are there some alternatives to those two things?
Well, golden seal, I rarely use the berberine plants except for topical infections or some sort of a GI tract infection that it's specific for. And then I use moderately high doses for a short period of time, 10 to 30 days max. I think golden seals, I've got a huge rant in the book about that. I think golden seal is way overused for the wrong things. It's really good for that, for GI tract infections, but I don't consider it really that relevant for colds and flu, for instance. Licorice is a whole other situation. Now, I've gone back and forth with licorice over the years. Licorice is a difficult herb because it can cause not only high blood pressure, but it can cause severe potassium depletion in the body, and it's also extremely estrogenic. So it can have a number of side effects for men, including breast growth if they're taking large doses. And I go into the side effects in a huge amount of detail in the book. The thing is, licorice should really never be used in isolation. It's an herb that should always be used with other things. And it's really, I consider it a short-term use herb. In other words, like most of these things, when you're talking about a resistant bacterial infection, you're not talking about something like high blood pressure or cholesterol or a heart problem that you're going to be using the herb every day for the rest of your life. You're looking at a short-term interventive therapy for an acute condition. So in that kind of a framework, licorice is perfect. You can use it in pretty high doses for a month at a time, blended with these other things, and in which case you're not going to have those kind of side effects. If somebody's already got high blood pressure and it could exacerbate that, I actually talk in there about some things you can add to licorice that will minimize those effects. But there's not really a very good substitute for licorice. It's an incredibly useful and potent herb. It's just that most people haven't understood both its strengths and weaknesses and best how to use it. So really, I look at it as an herb that you use for acute conditions short term, not as a long term herb for chronic conditions.
Is it important to monitor your pH when you're trying to use herbs?
You know, the pH thing it's an interesting thing, and I've only delved into that just a little bit. You know, and mostly when I was looking at mycoplasma infections, and I don't think it matters in the context that we're talking about, but it does turn out, for instance, if you have a mycoplasma infection, that mycoplasma bacteria, they do better if the pH of the body is abnormal. And so you have to look to some extent at adjusting the pH of the body with that organism. I haven't seen it make that much of an effect with these other things, no.
And you also talk about how important it is to keep your immune system healthy before you get sick. Can you tell me how to do that? I mean, it's obvious why it's important, but can you tell us some things that we can do to make sure that happens?
You know, the interesting thing is, as I got into studying Lyme disease and the co-infections of Lyme, which is sort of a subcategory of, you know, resistant bacteria or emerging infections, is that in study after study after study that I saw, the researchers would say over and over and over again that the healthier the immune system of whatever animal they were studying, including a human being, the healthier the immune system was, the less likely it was for the person or animal to get sick. And if they did get sick, the course of the disease would tend to be mild. So, and they would then work with, you know, increasing the immune parameters that were depressed, and they would see every time that the disease would have very little impact on the mouse or the rabbit or whatever they were looking at. So it's very important to keep immune health as healthy as you can. And as we age, of course, our immune health, all of our organs tend to, you know, be less vital, and our immune system goes down as well. So a number of the herbs that I've liked over time are, you know, there's probably four or five of them that I'm particularly partial to. Astragalus is probably one of the best overall ones that you can take all the time. It's a really, really good herb for just increasing the immune health and immune response. And that's one that's, it's a really good one to take as a tonic herb. Another one that I really like as a tonic herb is rhodiola, and I've become quite a fan of that particular one for a long time. They're kind of, both astragalus and ashwagandha, they're kind of what would be called a tonic adaptogen immune herbs, in that they're not so much immune stimulants, but that they help increase the ability of the immune system to respond to stressors, whether it's disease or overwork or whatever. Those are two of the very best of them. Ashwagandha is also a very good one. I use echinacea in really specific circumstances as an immune stimulant more than a tonic. Red root, I tend to include in this book. I've included it under the immune herbs, and what it really does is it potentiates the lymph system and stimulates the lymph response of the spleen and the lymph nodes to bacterial and viral infections. So those are some of my favorite ones that I use a lot.
Now, you use the word adaptogen. Would you mind educating my audience about what you mean an adaptogen is?
Yeah, adaptogens, that's a term that the Russians came up with back in the 60s, I believe it was. And they've done some really remarkable work along that line, and they just don't get enough respect. But what they found is that Eleutherococcus synticosis, it used to be called Siberian ginseng in the popular press, that's a particularly good adaptogen. It's more stimulatory than the others. But really what an adaptogen does is it increases the body's ability to respond to stressors, whatever the stressor is. It's nonspecific. So if you get a disease, that's a stressor on the system. And what the adaptogenic herb does is it optimizes the response of the immune system to the particular stressors that the disease, bacteria, or virus is initiating in the body. And so every bacteria and virus, for instance, are fungal organism. They'll create a slightly different process of inflammation and infection in the body. But with an adaptogen, the body then tends to respond to exactly what's needed for that. So that's an internal stressor. External stressors are overwork, are, you know, environmental difficulties, like if you're living at the North Pole, for instance, are doing deep sea diving or whatever, where you've got these exterior stressors on the body. The adaptogens help the body respond more efficiently to that, with so that your energy and your vitality stay high and your tendency to become ill is minimized, and that's really what they do.
So can I ask you now about some specific things, because I know a lot of people have these things I'm about to ask you about. Oh, before
sure.
I do that, I want to ask you, for the people who are gathering things, like I live in the Appalachian Mountains, and we have an abundance of herbs just growing wild in our backyard. Does it matter time of year and what part of plant? Yeah, I know it's wonderful. I just need to learn how to do it. What part of the plant we use? Can we just go pull it up anytime we want, or do we need to pull it at a particular time in a particular part of the plant?
For most plants, if I'm gathering a root, and you have to understand, I'm somewhat heretical, you know, in contemporary circles, but in general, in my experience after all these years, I found that most roots actually are better to harvest in the spring rather than in the fall. And there's some, you know, I give, you know, in-depth, detailed discussions of when and how to harvest all of these different plants in the book and how to prepare them as medicines. But if you're gathering a root, most people don't know this, but over the winter, plants that had died back, the above-ground plant dies back, the root still keeps growing all through the winter, even if the ground is frozen, and they store up a lot of nutrients, so they tend to be a lot more potent and bigger in the spring. An exception to that is, for instance, red root, a Ceanothus species. That root really needs a really good frost in the early winter or late fall for the roots to become as active as they can be. So each herb is slightly different. If you're gathering above-ground plants, if you're gathering the leaves, quite often there's some plants that you need to harvest prior to flowering, like boneset is one of those. Other plants, the flowers are extremely good to harvest, like if you're harvesting Artemisia species, like an Artemisia annua, which has a lot of artemisinin in it, and that's really good for malaria. The flowers have a huge amount of artemisinin in them, so you want to harvest it when the flowers are out. So each plant is slightly different, and there's slightly different times of year, but the book goes into all of that in detail, the best harvest times and what part and everything.
So if we harvest something at the right time, is it good to keep it? I mean, can we, like, dry it and it be just as effective?
Yeah, most of the stuff, there's some things like Bidens, to be effective as a systemic antibacterial, it needs to be made into medicine when it's fresh, when the leaves are fresh, because when they dry, the antibacterial substances change with drying, and it loses about 80% of its potency. But, for instance, golden seal roots are just as strong when they're dried as fresh. Philodendron bark, any of the berberine plants, the juniper berries are just as strong when they're dried. So a lot of these things, once you harvest them, if you then put them in, I put them, once they're really dry, I put them in plastic bags, and then I keep them inside big plastic tubs in a cool, dark room, so they'll last for years like that. And some roots will last 10, 15, 20 years if they're stored properly, so you don't need to harvest every year.
Okay, I just got an email from a woman who says that she has fourth-stage breast cancer. Do you have any recommendations for that?
You know, breast cancer is not a thing that I've worked with. I keep thinking about maybe I should start looking into that, but cancer in general. I have seen some studies, and I can't verify, or I can't, like, speak personally for them, but artemisinin has been found in a number of clinical settings to be extremely good for breast cancer and some, several other cancers, and you know, she might look at that. I do talk in this book about the different herbs that have been found effective for cancer, but it's not a primary field for me, and I just can't speak authoritatively about it.
Okay. So I'd like to ask you about some specific things that a lot of people have, and one of those I know that you know a lot about, particularly Lyme disease and mold toxicity. What can you tell us?
Well, okay, Lyme disease and the co-infections, there's probably, really the way most people talk about it now is Lyme and its co-infections, and the deeper I get into it, the more I'm starting to understand that really what we have is a series of diseases that are transmitted by what are called arthropods, which are basically ticks and mosquitoes and biting insects, essentially. And Lyme is the one that just became the most prominent, but it turns out there's probably at least five primary co-infections besides Lyme that are all generally transmitted to people that are all very serious problems. You know, Bartonella Babesia, Ehrlichia, Mycoplasma, and Anaplasma, and Lyme are probably the six that are most troubling, and there's a few others around the periphery. Lyme is actually, once you understand what Lyme does, it turns out that it's moderately easy to treat. It depends on some people's immune systems, if they're really depleted, or if they have some, or if they get, for whatever reason, a very virulent form of Lyme. It can be incredibly debilitating for people, where they're diagnosed as if they're having schizophrenia or multiple sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease or whatever. But basically, the best herb for Lyme disease is Japanese knotweed. It's Polygonum cuspidatum, and it's the root. It's, interestingly enough, that plant is an invasive botanical all up the East Coast, and pretty much wherever Lyme is endemic, it tends to grow. So the root of it, what it does is it basically it stops all of the inflammation that the Lyme bacteria causes. Lyme gets into the body, and it's a parasite, so it needs to break down certain structures in the body in order to get the nutrients it needs, and it breaks down collagen tissue. So if it breaks them down in the joints, you get Lyme arthritis. If it breaks it down in the central nervous system, you get central nervous system Lyme, Neurella borreliosis, and then you start getting these kind of central nervous system things that look like Alzheimer's or multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's or whatever. So if you, that Japanese knotweed root is a really great central herb to then build a protocol around, because it will stop the processes that the Lyme bacteria use to break down those collagen structures. And right there, that will begin to stop a lot of the symptoms. And if you then build up the immune system and your immune functioning, which the best herb for that in Lyme is cat's claw, Uncaria tomentosa, it's extremely... But
okay.
But anyway, if people use Japanese knotweed root and cat's claw and then sort of build a protocol around that, most of the people have experienced substantial help from that, and that's a really good way to begin.
And,
in terms of,
so,
you asked about mold toxicity,
yes.
And really the only kind of mold I've worked with is Aspergillus, which is also a resistant organism, and it's not something, most of the mold stuff, I haven't worked like with the black mold that people have a lot of problems with. I've never really worked much with that, but Aspergillus is real responsive to those systemic antibacterials I talked about, Cryptolepis and Ceta and Alcornia, so... It's extremely good for that.
Another thing I wanted to ask about was lung infections, kidney support, gallbladder support.
Well, lung infections, it's interesting. One of the best things for lung infections is Bidens, because Bidens is extremely good for protecting mucous membrane systems and helping tone and normalize the mucous membranes, whether it's in the lungs or the urinary passages or the GI tract or even the reproductive tract. So that's one with lung infections that I tend to use. You know, the systemics are good there. If it's like a viral lung infection, ginger is probably one of the best things to use. And ginger is an extremely good synergist. It's moderately antibacterial, but it's strongly antiviral if you use the fresh juice. And that's one of the primary things I use for influenzas and things like that where there's serious lung infections of one sort or another.
Work to do, like, ginger capsules or powder ginger?
No, that's completely useless. That stuff, the way that all of the traditional cultures around the world have always used ginger as the fresh juice. And they get it, the juice, a variety of different ways. But the capsules themselves, that works to some extent for nausea and things like that. But when ginger dries, it loses most of its antibacterial and all of its antiviral qualities. So you really have to use the fresh juice for that. So it's really spectacularly good, and for flew even like it's like, for instance, for West Nile encephalitis are really severe lung infections. I use a blend of fresh ginger juice and hot water. You make a ginger juice tea basically with some cayenne and honey and lime and drink 4 to 6 cups of that a day. But I also use an herb called lomatium, and that's an extremely good herb for those kind of conditions as well.
Okay. What about menopause? So many people are going to me even right now. You know, I'm 52, and that's happening to me. What can we do for that?
Well, there's a number of herbs for that. You know, of course, because I'm male, I'm more interested in andropause, which is the male equivalent, which is how I got into studying pine pollen and phytoandrogens, plants that have male androgens like testosterone in them. But, you know, there's a pretty good body of work on estrogenic plants for women. And, you know, black cohosh is good. Hops have more estrogenic substances in them than almost any plant on earth. Vitex is really good. So you can actually make a nice combination of herbs like that and then begin taking them every day, and it really will reduce hot flashes considerably.
Okay. There's something I've been reading a lot about. I don't know how to say it. Eleuthero? Is that how you say it?
Eleutherococcus?
Yeah.
Eleuthero? Yeah,
what
Eleuthero's,
is that?
That's an adaptogenic herb that used to be called Siberian ginseng, and you can still see it called that occasionally. It's a member of the ginseng family, and it's an adaptogenic herb, but I think of it more, there's two varieties of it that you can get. There's the German formulation, which is very strong, and there's a company in the United States called Herb Farm that sells that, and it's almost black in color, the tincture is, and that's more of an adaptogenic stimulant. It's very strong. But if you get it where it's made less strong than that, it's more of a tonic, and then the tincture will be kind of a golden color, and you can use it. You can take it long term that way, and it's a very good herb for that.
What do you use it for?
Well, I use it in, for instance, in Lyme disease. One of the major things, complaints that people have is severe fatigue. So a lot of people with chronic infections that are fairly deep will present with kind of a chronic fatigue sort of syndrome. And one of the herbs that I've used for that to help bring their energy back up is Eleutherococcus, the Herb Farm formulation, because it's more stimulatory. And so if you start taking it, it will increase your immune function, but it'll also begin to increase your energy levels. Ashwagandha is another good herb for that. For some people, if people have insomnia, ashwagandha will quite often begin to put them to sleep. So usually people should try that one in the evening before bed just to see if they're having that response to it. But, you know, those herbs, rhodiola will over time increase energy for people.
Can you take the powdered form of it?
You can, with rhodiola and Eleutherococcus, you pretty much have to use the tincture if you want to use it for that. Ashwagandha, you can use the powder. For some things, I'm really into the powder. Other things, tinctures. With rhodiola and Eleutherococcus, I actually prefer the tinctures.
Okay, because I've just been seeing that name, Eleuthero, all the time now, but I didn't know what to.
It's a good herb. If you think it's like, you would think of it as like, it's kind of like a ginseng, but it's a little bit milder than the Asian ginseng, and it has slightly different qualities. But if you think about it as a ginseng kind of plant, then that gives you an idea of what it does.
Okay. We have about 8 minutes left. Please, could you talk about anything that we've not talked about that you think, or maybe even berberine, we haven't talked much about that. But talk about anything you think that we need to know that we haven't talked about.
Okay. Well, the thing that I think is most important, and I've seen this a lot in dealing with the Lyme community and other people like that, is, you know, we've been trained in the United States to put the care of our bodies in the hands of a group of specialists. And we've been trained to believe that they know everything that needs to be known about disease, and we can go to them and they'll help us. But unfortunately, it's turning out that really isn't true. And one of the major things I've encountered in the Lyme community and in some of the survivors of resistant infection community is they're horrified to find out that the physicians really don't understand very well what's going on and don't understand very easily how to help them. And what they learn over time is that they have to begin to take back control of their health care for themselves. Now, there's a lot of people, specialist groups in the United States, like physicians, for instance, who are very much opposed to that idea because they think that the American population is too stupid to be able to do this. And you'll see comments like that very commonly a lot of places. I'm very much not in favor of that kind of approach because we're the ones that are dealing with our bodies and the ones that are dealing with disease. And given the way everything is shifting now, it becomes more and more important all the time for people to begin to engage in health self-empowerment. I think it's very, very important. And, you know, some people may think that a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is somewhat alarmist and over the top. But the thing is that every major bacterial researcher in the world, at every institution that there is, it doesn't matter where, they're saying the same thing, that we've got this problem, the age of antibiotics is over, and within our lifetime, they will no longer be usable as a primary interventive for these kind of things. It's a very scary kind of proposition, but nevertheless, what's important is people beginning to understand that and beginning to start to work to take charge of their own health care again. And that's really something that I've been supporting for most of my career, and that's a lot of the reason why I wrote this book.
Let's see. We got just a couple minutes left. Could you say anything about turmeric or quercetin?
Well, quercetin is an interesting supplement. It turns out, because I just finished, actually for this book that we're talking about now, I actually wrote a chapter on herbal antivirals for this book, but it turned out that the book was too long and they had to take it out. And then they said, you know, that would make a good book on its own, so will you write that? So there's another book about this size. It'll be coming out next year on herbal antivirals for resistant and emerging viruses. And the quercetin is something that showed up over and over as I was developing that book, and that it's got some fairly strong antiviral qualities to it. And so if you begin to add it into formulations that you're using or add it into a protocol, it's extremely effective for that. I mean, I tended to think of it more as, you know, a structural support for, let's say, blood vessels and things, but it's really much more broadly active. It's got various antimicrobial actions to it, so it's actually a fairly nice supplement to understand about. Turmeric I've used mostly in treating hepatitis C, and it's a pretty good herb for that, although it'll stain your clothes if you're not careful, if you spill it on yourself, but it's extremely good for helping the liver function more optimally, and it's a fairly strong, it's got its own fairly strong antibacterial qualities to it. The problem is they just don't cross the GI tract membrane very well. They don't really go systemic, and the elements of it that do cross the GI tract membrane are routed to the liver for disposal, and that's why it has such good liver function. So, you know, there's a lot of really great herbs out there. Virtually everything that we see around us is a magnificent medicinal plant if only we will take the time to learn about it.
Well, I have to say one of the things that I've really learned from this book is so many people, when they hear some particular thing is good for whatever disease or problem, they run down to the health food store and they buy a bottle of capsules. And what I've learned in this book is that's not always going to work, that you have to take a specific form, a tincture or I don't know what else.
Right,
the other
so it's, that's the thing. The the form, the dosage, the length of time you take it is all very, very important. And after a while, once you start, I mean, it's like learning any kind of a new skill. Once you spend some time with it, it'll start to make sense. And it doesn't have to be that scary or mysterious, really.
Well, this is a great book, Stephen. Please tell us one more time where we can find it.
Well, Amazon.com, oddly enough, that when the book came out, Amazon got copies right away, and I just got mine a couple of days ago. So Amazon is really the best place to get it because it's also going to be cheaper there. And so, but really, the publisher's been pretty good at getting the book out there, and as far as I know, most bookstores around the country will have it now.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm going to call you soon and have you come back because there's just too much information to cover in one show. It's a fabulous book. Thank you for taking the time to do it for humanity.
You're welcome, Eva. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Have a good evening.
Okay,
good night.
Bye-bye.